This is the Mahabharata Podcast, episode 49, Peace Talks Begin. Last time, the Pandavas met with their closest allies and made plans for their next move. While it isn't stated clearly, it seems their preliminary strategy was to build up a huge fighting force, and only then, when they were in a position to mount an offensive, did they decide to send an ambassador. Much of the book of the effort, so far, has been about the amassing of these armies on both sides of the conflict. Arjuna and Duryodhana both visited Krishna in person to ask for his support. Famously, Arjuna chose Krishna, unarmed and out of the fight, over Krishna's vast armies, which went over to the Kaurava side. Duryodhana won another round in the game of alliances when he surreptitiously provided lodging and entertainment for King Shalya and his army. Shalya was tricked into changing sides, but he still continued on to Upaplavya, where he reported what he had done to the Pandavas. In consolation, Shalya promised to stir up trouble with Karna to help throw him off his game. For added reassurance, Shalya also told him the story of Indra's victory. This story was also useful because it filled in more details about Nahusha and how he became a snake. Back when Nahusha explained his downfall, he said he had been a great king, but he didn't mention that he'd actually held Indra's job temporarily. The whole piece is a splendid example of Brahmin propaganda. It begins with a Brahmin who has an unexplained grudge against Indra, and he is powerful enough to conjure a being that threatens Indra's exalted status. Indra behaved according to his dharma in striking this impostor before he was strong enough to resist. But still, the king of the gods had committed the crime of killing a Brahmin, which is not allowed in any circumstance. Thus, even though Indra was acting in legitimate self-defense, he still had to suffer for this crime. Indra's triumph over the terrible Asura Vritra did nothing to allay his misery. Indra lost his mind and went into hiding. Nahusha was elected king of heaven by the general accord of both gods and the rishis. When Nahusha demurs because he lacks superpowers, it is the Brahmins who cook up a new superpower just for him. It is interesting that when the power goes to his head and he wants to exert his dominance in heaven, he expresses it by placing himself above the Brahmin caste. The resistance against Nahusha, led by Sachi, is nevertheless masterminded by the Brahmin Brihaspati. Finally, Nahusha is quite easily deposed once he offended the Brahmin Agastya. You get the impression that this god-king, who terrorized and intimidated all the gods and asuras, was as nothing compared to the puissant Agastya. The last item I'd like to point out about this story is the interesting scene where Kubera, Yama, and Varuna squeeze their own domains out of Indra in return for their help in battling Nahusha. They get to keep their spoils, even though the Brahmins ended up doing all the hard work. By the end of this, poor Indra had been thoroughly emasculated by the Brahmins. I guess it's no wonder that Shiva, another Brahmin, took over Indra's cult of worshippers within a few more centuries. When all the storytelling was done, the Pandavas had amassed 7 grand armies of troops. The Kauravas did even better, assembling 11 grand armies in total. Now, with both sides ready to fight, they opened up negotiations. The Pandavas sent King Drupad's house priest, who is so far unnamed, to the court of Hastinapur. This anonymous diplomat gave a very convincing account of the many wrongs which the Pandavas had suffered and how very reasonable they were being despite it all. They only want what had been agreed upon 13 years earlier, and to reconcile with their kin. On the other hand, they have 7 armies at the ready. He knew full well that the Kauravas outnumbered them 11-7, but with Arjuna and Krishna combined on the battlefield, well, let's say it's in your best interest to come to an agreement. It was Bhishma who responded to the Brahmin's case. The old prince expressed his joy in hearing that the Pandavas had made such a quick comeback, and even more so since they desired a settlement over war. He agreed that the Pandavas had served their term, and they certainly deserved their side of the bargain. In his paternal joy, Bhishma's mind wandered to the well-being of his nephews, and he praised Arjuna for his many accomplishments. During their exile. While he was waxing on about how great his nephew was, Karna jumped in, saying, "Yes, yes, we know all that. What's the point in talking about this over and over again? On Duryodhana's behalf, Shakuni defeated Yudhishthira at dice, and according to our agreement, they went to live in the forest. Now, for some reason, they have forgotten the agreement, and they've come back begging for land and threatening to use foreign armies if we don't give in to their demands." If it were required by his dharma, Duryodhana would give up the whole earth, but he will cede nothing in the face of threats. If the Pandavas wish to adhere to dharma, then let them return to the woods, where they shall be protected by their cousins and have nothing to fear. If, on the other hand, they want to give up their virtue and make war, then war it shall be. Bhishma replied, "What are you talking about? Just a while back you were driven from the field by Arjun. If we ignore this embassy, we shall all surely be killed on the battlefield." If you recall back at the end of the book of Virata, I mentioned that it seemed that it was Duryodhana who was calling all the shots and that his father may possibly have been in retirement. Well, for some reason in this book, Dhritarashtra has taken back the reins of power. So it was the blind king who had the final say. Dhritarashtra's ruling was, first, Karna was a ninny and should hold his tongue. He praised Bhishma's speech and continued, "Bhishma Santanava has spoken for our best interests. I shall send Sanjay to negotiate with the Pandavas." The old king then dismissed Drupad's Brahmin, sending him back to his masters, and then summoned his driver and confidant, Sanjay the charioteer. I find Dhritarashtra's instructions to Sanjay a little puzzling. He began well enough, praising the Pandavas' virtue and restraint, decrying the injustices acted against them, and blaming Duryodhana and calling for peace between them. The crucial bit of instruction he left out was what were the terms for this peace. The king simply instructed Sanjay to tell them he desired peace. The scene then cuts to the Pandava camp, with Sanjay bearing Dhritarashtra's message. The charioteer inquired after the Pandavas' health, to which Yudhishthira replied that they were all doing quite well. The Pandava then returned the inquiry, asking after the health of each of the Kaurava elders and counselors, the women, and the 100 Kaurava brothers. He then went on, "And do they recall the straight-flying arrows that flew at them from the Gandava bow? Do they recall the defeat that befell them in the Dvaita forest, and how Bhimasena and Arjun set them free again? Surely these good deeds should not be ignored." Sanjay replied with his lord's compliments, and then recited what Dhritarashtra had said before he departed. He supplemented that speech with a laudatory speech on the virtues of peace, the evils of war, and concluded by boasting of the size of the Kuru armies and the greatness of their generals. Although I had trouble making out what Dhritarashtra's terms were, Yudhishthira figured it out right away. The old prick was suggesting that they should just go away peacefully. No land, no titles, just go away. Yudhishthira naturally took exception to this on a couple of points. He said, "What did I ever say to you of war? War is folly. We seek only the fulfillment of dharma and the common good. I think it is your king who is in need of some self-reflection. He has never experienced poverty or even inferior luxuries, yet he is asking us to restrain ourselves and live in penury. What I fail to grasp is how you guys think you can keep everything to yourselves and get away with it. The best warrior you've got is Karna, but what good has he done for you so far? You only got away with these injustices because Arjun was out of commission, but now he's back, and you would be crazy to think you could cross him and survive. You know what we've been through, yet we have forgiven all that, but now I must have my realm and my city Indraprastha. Let your master grant that." Sanjay then launched into a lengthy sermon on the evils of war and went so far as to recommend that they would be happier giving up on all their claims than to go to war with their cousins. I've always liked Sanjay, and I know he was just doing his job, but my estimation of Dhritarashtra's chauffeur dropped a few notches after this exchange. Yudhishthira cautioned Sanjay that the ways of dharma are subtle, and a sutta like he ought to keep away from such highfalutin topics. He deferred to Krishna to judge whether this war was dharmically permitted or not. Krishna was there, and he made a long speech to the effect that the Pandavas were justified in taking up arms if the Kauravas did not hand over their lands as promised. I'm sparing you the speechifying, which goes on for pages. When Krishna concluded, he made a nice analogy. He said the Kauravas were like a forest, and the Pandavas were like the tigers in the forest. If the tigers are removed, the forest will soon be cut down. If the forest is cut down, the tigers could not survive. Therefore, he advocated peace. But if the Kauravas refused, then there shall surely be war, and the Pandavas will be in the right. Everyone having said their piece, Sanjay made his farewells and departed for Hastinapur. I guess he was only following orders when he was being so hard on the Pandavas, because as soon as he got back and reported to the king, Sanjay really laid into the old man. He excoriated King Dhritarashtra for his past bad behavior, saying, "I blame you for the discord among the Bharatas. and the way you are going, you will surely bring about the extinction of your family. Sanjay concluded his diatribe, saying, "The chariot ride was pretty rough. I'm tired. With your leave, I shall go to bed now. Tomorrow the Kurus shall hear in the open court the message that Ajatasattru has sent." When Sanjay left, even though it was late, King Dhritarashtra sent a runner to fetch his younger brother, Vidur. When Vidur arrived, Dhritarashtra said, "Sanjay has returned. He came to see me, berated me for all the bad stuff I did, and then went to bed. He said tomorrow he'll be relaying Yudhishthira's message in the assembly hall. I don't know what he's going to say, and it's making me nervous. I can't sleep. Do you have any suggestions?" Vidur replied, "Insomnia affects three kinds of people. Those who are weak with a strong foe, those who have lost everything to a lover, and thieves. Surely you're not one of these." Probably mostly interested in just killing time, or maybe it helped him to sleep. But in any case, the king asked his brother to tell him all about Dharma and true wisdom. Old Vidur loved nothing better than to give a long sermon, even this late at night, so he commenced with a dense lecture on virtue and good behavior, occasionally slipping in references to the Pandava's dilemma. This goes on for pages. If someone were to extract all of Vidur's advice and wisdom from this epic, it would certainly make a good-sized book in itself. Dhritarashtra kept Vidur talking all night, sometimes priming the pump with questions, such as which lineage of Brahmins was superior. By daybreak, Dhritarashtra must have run out of questions, because he just asked, "Is there anything else you haven't mentioned? I'd love to hear it." Vidur must have gotten a little punch drunk by then, because he brought up the name of what he called the ancient and eternal youth, Sanat Sujata. Vidur said, "Sanat Sujata has proclaimed that there is no death. He, the foremost of the spirits, can tell you these great secrets." The king asked, "Then why don't you just tell me now what he has to say?" Vidur reminded his brother that he'd been born of a Shudra serving girl, and thus he did not feel worthy of passing on this spiritual knowledge. Dhritarashtra replied, "Then tell me, brother, how may I hear this message here and now?" What happens next is a little unclear. The critical edition says that Vidur thought of Sanat Sujata, and then The critical edition just says that Vidur thought of Sanat Sujata, and then Sanat Sujata began speaking with Dhritarashtra. It makes me think that maybe Vidur was some kind of spirit channeler or medium, and it was he speaking for the spirit of the immortal sage. As usual, Ganguly provides more details, however spurious, to explain this. In that version, it says that Vidur basically summoned the rishi with his mind, and the sage appeared before them to make his conversation. I still like the former interpretation, because once Sanat Sujata began speaking, Vidur stopped. We don't hear from Vidur for the rest of the session. I know that spirit channels in the West go back to ancient times, but this may be the first reference to the practice in India that I have ever heard of. I wonder if there's a tradition of that sort in Hindu practice. Regardless, the dialogue between Dhritarashtra and the immortal commenced. If Vidur's previous lecture was dense, the spirit's teachings were beyond dense. So dense, in fact, that the meaning was somehow squeezed out of it. Frankly, I can't make much sense of any of it, and it goes on for pages. In case you don't believe me, here's a sample. Dhritarashtra said to him, "Sanat Sujata, they tell me that you teach there is no such thing as death, yet the gods and asuras fought hard to attain freedom from death. So which is true?" The sage replied, "Some say that immortality is won by rituals. Others say there is no death at all. I tell you that the death that the sages believe in is folly. I say to you that distraction is death, and not to be distraught is to live forever. Yet death is no tiger that eats people. No shape is ever perceived of death. Some say Yama is death, others say it is someone else, but non-death is study sunk in the soul. The God holds sway in the world of the fathers, being safe to the safe, unsafe to the unsafe." It goes on like this for pages. It makes me wonder, what good is being immortal if you're also senile? Every once in a while, he nearly starts making sense, but then I lose the meaning again. Perhaps it is just too deep for me. In any case, the dialogue went on like this for the rest of the night. The next morning, the court gathered to hear Sanjay deliver the Pandava's message. I'll cut it off there. Next time, we'll find out what kind of olive branch Yudhishthira is willing to extend to his cousins. When negotiations begin to break down, Krishna steps in as the Pandava's new ambassador. Thanks for listening.